The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Without freedom of the press, no democratic form of government could exist.
We switch you now to London.
I'm standing on a rooftop looking out over London.
Good night and good luck.
Good evening from our CBS newsroom in New York.
NBC presents Chet Huntley and David Brinkley.
From ABC, this is World News Tonight. With Peter Jennings in London, Max Robinson in Chicago, and from our desk in Washington, Frank Reynolds.
Good evening.
This historic legislation, the telecommunications law, will create many, many high-wage jobs, will create opportunity and better lives for all Americans.
When the press is free, the people of a country are free. When the press is not free, the people of a country are in danger of slavery.
Keeping you informed with information, news, and the views of people making the news. It's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
All right, we made it to a Wednesday, so we're at the midpoint of the week. We are a week away from the first Democratic debates. Yeah. And, well, there's a lot to talk about today. I'll fill you in after our opening number. As you know, I try to start the show each day with something humorous to take the edge off as we go forward and talk about things that will likely get our blood pressure to rise. Today's segment, it's a song, is funny, but it's more poignant than funny. But when I saw it this morning, I knew that that's how I had to begin today's show. So we'll start today with a new one from Don Caron and the Parody Project. Keep your fingers crossed that the video works for the YouTubers, because this one it's really good. I'm impressed. So take it away, Parody Project. Fingers crossed.
When Johnny comes rolling home again, Iran, Iran, we know he'll never roam again, Iran, Iran. When his legs don't work and his shoulder droops, but that's okay, we support the troops. We will all think twice when Johnny comes rolling home. When our boy comes back broke and bent, Iran, Iran, we'll wonder why he ever went, Iran, Iran. McConnell gets all his contracts done, and a coward claims he's the favorite son, but we'll all think twice when Johnny comes rolling home.
The White House thinks they'll do the job,
Iran, Iran.
They'll never hear our Johnny sob,
Iran, Iran. They have no idea who attacked our boats. It's buried in John Bolton's notes. Trump will not be there when Johnny comes rolling home.
Again, they tell us there's a threat,
Iran, Iran.
How gullible do we have to get, Iran, Iran?
They tell us that we must strike back to avenge a fictitious non-attack. It will be for naught when Johnny comes rolling home. We wait for Johnny to arrive, Iran, Iran. He will be more dead than alive, Iran, Iran. He joined to fight for the USA, can't understand, he'll get tossed away. But we'll all wake up when Johnny comes rolling home.
Wow. As I said, more poignant than funny today, but I thought that needed to be heard. When Johnny Comes Rolling Home is what the Parody Project calls that rendition of When Johnny Comes Marching Home. Again, the guy is, it's one guy doing all those vocals. And Don Karen does this on all his videos. If you go to Parody, P-A-R-O-D-Y, parodyproject.com, you'll find all his stuff. Some of them are not quite so well done. Some of them are a little schlocky. Some of them go on too long. But the guy's talented. But this video, this production, this four-part harmony was just magnificent and quite telling, quite apropos for these times when we have an administration and just a reprehensible, vile, sickening excuse for a human being pretending to be president. Well, occupying the Oval Office. Oh, and destroying this country. And probably lying us into another war. That one was great, right? I'm still in awe. And it's about the fifth time I've heard it, because at the first time I heard it, I'm like, oh my God, I got to listen to that again. Do they perform on Fox? I don't think so. And again, it's one guy. It's this guy, Don Karen. I will embed that video in today's blog post at NicoleSandler.com. If you ever miss the show and you don't subscribe to it on YouTunes or iTunes or any of the other podcasts, apps. You can always get it on my blog at NicoleSandler.com. And again, I will embed that video. Do you feel like you need like a palate cleanser? Do we need something funny? Or should I save the fun? We'll save the funny for tomorrow. Yes, Parody Project is also on YouTube. And again, they're not like roll on the floor hysterically funny like I believe Randy Rainbow is. Yeah, just he does great work. So anyway, there's that. Okay. Usually on this program around now is when I tell you what guest we have coming up. Today I will tell you we do not have a guest, and it wasn't for lack of trying either. This was one of those days that every call I put out, for whatever reason, the people that I was interested in talking to today were not available. So that's okay, because it gives us time to open the phones, to open it up for you guys to call in, to comment on anything that's on your mind, anything that you'd like to discuss. There's certainly a lot of news to cover, and there's more today that I wanted to spend a little time on. I was hoping to have a guest on the topic, but that didn't happen. So let me tell you, I feel kind of bad that as a white woman of privilege who grew up in New York and South Florida, I'm almost embarrassed to say I never knew what Juneteenth was. In fact, until I don't know how many years ago, but a few years ago, I had never even heard of it, which I think is quite tragic when you look at what Juneteenth is all about. So we're going to spend a little time today going through that. There was a hearing today in the House Judiciary Subcommittee on the Constitution, Civil Rights, and Civil Liberties on reparations and a bill that is currently before Congress. It's H.R. 40, and it was sponsored by Sheila Jackson Lee. And basically, the description of the bill reads thusly: to address the fundamental injustice, cruelty, brutality, and inhumanity of slavery in the United States and the 13 American colonies between 1619 and 1865, and to establish a commission to study and consider a national apology and proposal for reparations for the institution of slavery, its subsequent de jure, and de facto racial and economic discrimination against African Americans, and the impact of those forces on living African Americans, to make recommendations to the Congress on appropriate remedies and for other purposes. So I want to play for you a couple of the opening statements from that hearing, but there's a little background we need to go into first. But before we get there, someone took me up on my offer to call in. We go to the 562 area code. Hi, who's this?
Hi, Nicole. This is George calling from Coarse Gold, California.
Hey, George. How are things out in California? Is it still like ridiculously hot?
You got it. About 100 today.
Wow. Oh, hotter than here. Okay.
I was calling because I heard a little bit of the Stephanopoulos interview with
Dump. Yeah.
And he, at one point they were talking about calling the FBI, and Trump said, why would I call the FBI? Nobody calls the FBI and all this stuff.
Yep. Uh-huh.
And what Stephanopoulos should have done, and I know it's easy for me to say because I'm not in that position, but he should have said, is there any situation where you would call the FBI?
Yeah.
For instance, if a foreign national or a foreign government or a foreign intelligence service was blackmailing you, would you call them then?
Right.
That's what he should have asked him.
There are a lot of questions you should have asked him. I'm actually trying to pull up a thread that I read. There's a great journalist named Mehdi Hassan who writes for, I wish I knew how to spell his name and I could probably pull it up. And I'm not having luck with it. No, that's not him either. Anyway, he writes for The Intercept, and he does a show for Al Jazeera, and he does a podcast as well. And he wrote an amazing thread sort of lamenting the fact that George Stephanopoulos had this great opportunity to ask Donald Trump questions and follow-up questions, and he didn't take advantage of it. And I was hoping I could share that thread with you, but I cannot find it now. If I come across it, I will share it later. But you know, you're right. There were so many ways he could have followed up. And actually, he did a better job than most do with him, because most journalists don't challenge him. I think they're afraid of losing access. So he tried to push a little bit, but certainly not enough.
Well, thanks for taking my call.
Sure. Thank you for calling. It's good to hear from you. Take care out there in California. All right. So let me start with, again, I was looking for a guest to sort of explain the history of Juneteenth. Because, again, as I said, and I'm somewhat embarrassed to say it, but if I can't be honest with you guys, I can't be honest with anyone. I grew up never hearing the word, let alone celebrating what should be a holiday. So I came across, and I looked, and there were a number of things. Of course, Ta-Nehisi Coates wrote a great piece on reparations a while ago. But for background on Juneteenth, honestly, there's not a whole lot out there. So let me share with you a little bit from a woman named Jamila Nasheed, who has an article today in Teen Vogue. Now, I know you might say Teen Vogue. Teen Vogue, although it sounds like it's like a fashion magazine for teenagers, is very politically conscious, socially conscious. They are doing some great journalism and have for the past couple of years or so. And so I was not surprised when I saw this really good article on Juneteenth in Teen Vogue. That's where I found this, again, by Jamila Nasheed. And she writes, and I'll only share with you part of it. I will link to this article again from my blog at NicoleSandler.com today. But in her article, What is Juneteenth? How is it celebrated? And why does it matter? There's a section called How Did Juneteenth Get Started? And I'm sorry if you already know this, but for people like me, yes, Deconstructed is Mehdi Hassan's podcast. Thank you. All right, so here's what she writes. President Abraham Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation on January 1st, 1863. It was intended, many were told, to free all the slaves. But in August of 1862, President Lincoln wrote an open letter to Horace Greeley, the editor of the New York Tribune, in which he described his actions as intent to preserve the Union rather than to abolish slavery. This is an interesting distinction, right? Quote, my paramount object in the struggle is to save the Union and is not either to save or destroy slavery, Lincoln wrote. If I could save the Union without freeing any slave, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing all the slaves, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing some and leaving others alone, I would also do that. What I do about slavery and the colored race, I do because I believe it helps to save this Union. That's the end of the quote. The article says then, famous for his honesty, Lincoln clearly viewed his decree more as a political tool than a means of liberation. Its impact bears that out, she writes. Lincoln's 1863 Emancipation Proclamation declared, quote, that all persons held as slaves within the rebellious state are henceforth and shall be free. This meant that the proclamation only applied to states that had seceded from the Union, from the United States, leaving slavery intact in border states and southern states under northern control. In addition, the promise of the abolishment of slavery was contingent on the Union Army winning the Civil War, which didn't happen until April 1865. But even after that, the Union had to enforce emancipation. In Texas, approximately 250,000 people were still being held in slavery when on June 19, 1865, Union troops led by Major General Gordon Granger arrived in Galveston to announce that the war had ended and that all the slaves were now free. I just got goosebumps reading that. Wow. Granger delivered General Order Number 3, which said, quote, the people of Texas are informed that, in accordance with a proclamation from the executive of the United States, all slaves are free. This involves an absolute equality of personal rights and rights of property between former masters and slaves, and the connection heretofore existing between them becomes that between employer and hired labor. End quote. Although slavery wouldn't legally end in all states until the December 1865 ratification of the 13th Amendment, June 19th, hello, today, which became known as Juneteenth, was the day when the last American slaves were freed, resulting in massive celebrations. Great. So then she has a section, again, I'm sharing from an article appearing today in Teen Vogue, written by a woman named Jamila Nasheed. So then there's a section on how do people celebrate Juneteenth. And little did I know, as a child in New York or a teenager in South Florida growing up, that Juneteenth celebrations happened in that first year, starting in 1866. Since then, celebrations in certain regions of the U.S. have continued the tradition of honoring this important day. In 1872, a group of former slaves put together $800 and purchased 10 acres of land in Houston, Texas, for that city's annual Juneteenth celebrations. They named the space Emancipation Park, and Juneteenth celebrations are held there today. So, but again, it says year after year since, small pockets of the United States have erupted in celebration of the day when everybody in the U.S. was declared free, while the day has gone largely unnoticed in the majority of the country. So I guess I don't feel so bad because the majority of the country, I guess, had been as ignorant on the subject as I was. So now there's a section, and I want to read to you because it's important. The section is entitled, Why Does Juneteenth Matter? Juneteenth represents the good and the bad in what makes the United States the country it is. It's symbolic of a liberation, but one that was delayed due to consistent opposition and resistance to equality that is deeply rooted in white supremacy, something that all too often feels very American. Those last American slaves were declared free months after they had actually been freed, and still freedom wasn't granted overnight. Some slave owners withheld this information from their slaves until after harvest season, delaying freedom even further. Even now, the idea of delayed freedom resonates. What is freedom when you're seen and treated as subhuman? From the original Juneteenth to 2019's Juneteenth, Black people have endured a continuous fight for equality and a different kind of freedom. Quote, today's political climate is the result of a concerted effort over many years to teach individuals a revised history, that the system of slavery was related to states' rights, when in fact it was a treasonous act that this nation must not revisit. One of the many ways we can prevent another uprising of a treasonous act like slavery is to recognize milestones like Juneteenth. That's a quote from Derek Johnson, the president of the NAACP, who continued, quote, I think the significance and purpose of recognizing Juneteenth is something that all citizens should acknowledge, because if there's not a retelling or remembrance of the true history of this nation, we're doomed to repeat it. And it goes on from there. She then goes on to quote Frederick Douglass. This section, it's almost done, continues, "In a country that prides itself on being the land of the free, this is just one of our many national contradictions and hypocrisies, another one of which is notably right around the corner, the 4th of July. It's a day meant to celebrate when America declared independence from the British in 1776 and is referred to as Independence Day, despite the fact that Black Americans weren't even considered to be people at that time." Quote, "This 4th of July is yours, not mine. You may rejoice, I must mourn." This is the quote from Frederick Douglass, said on July 5th, 1852, during an event commemorating the signing of the Declaration of Independence. Quote, "I am not included within the pale of glorious anniversary. Your high independence only reveals the immeasurable distance between us. The blessings in which you this day rejoice are not enjoyed in common. The rich inheritance of justice, liberty, prosperity, and independence bequeathed by your fathers is shared by you, not by me." End quote. As Frederick Douglass expertly laid out, that day of independence does not mark liberation for all. What Juneteenth symbolizes, by contrast, is a true day of freedom. That's something worth celebrating and continuing to fight for, not just among black folks, but among everybody. Again, that's an excerpt from this article, "What is Juneteenth? How is it celebrated and why does it matter?" written by Jamila Nasheed. It's at Teen Vogue. I will post a link to that article on my blog at NicoleSandler.com along with today's podcast after the show. I did try to reach out to Jamila Nasheed. I emailed her and tried to get her on Twitter. Didn't hear back from her, but I did try to get her on the show to talk about this. This is the way my day has been working out. But again, I think it's going to work out fine because I wanted to share that with you and share a little bit more on what's going on today. Today, Juneteenth. The House Judiciary Subcommittee on the Constitution, Civil Rights, and Civil Liberties is holding a hearing on reparations today. It's on this, as I said earlier, H.R. 40, a bill sponsored by Sheila Jackson Lee, the Commission to Study and Develop Reparation Proposals for African Americans Act. So they're holding their hearing on this today, I'm sure not coincidentally, because of today. So I watched a little bit of the hearing, and I wanted to share with you two of the opening arguments. The first is from author, journalist Ta-Nehisi Coates, who had written, or Ta-Nehisi Coates, I think is how he pronounces it, who had written a great primer on reparations some months ago. And, well, here's his opening statement. It's going to run about 5 minutes. But, again, I think this is a really important topic worthy of discussion. And before I get to him, obviously, Ta-Nehisi Coates is in favor of reparations. And then I'm going to play for you the opening statement from another columnist and author named Coleman Hughes, who is against reparations. Now, I got to tell you, I don't have a strong stance, and I've been trying to work out getting some guests on to talk about it. This is obviously not my area of expertise, and I feel a little inadequate in discussing it, so I'm going to let others speak. And it's something we can discuss. I'd love to hear what you think about it. So let's start. Let's go to the tape. And Ta-Nehisi Coates testifying this morning at the House hearing on reparations. Here's what he said.
"Yesterday, when asked about reparations, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell offered a familiar reply. America should not be held liable for something that happened 150 years ago. Since none of us currently alive are responsible. This rebuttal proffers a strange theory of governance, that American accounts are somehow bound by the lifetime of its generations. But well into this century, the United States was still paying out pensions to the heirs of Civil War soldiers. We honor treaties that date back some 200 years, despite no one being alive who signed those treaties. Many of us would love to be taxed for the things we are solely and individually responsible for. But we are American citizens and thus bound to a collective enterprise that extends beyond our individual and personal reach.
Of course, I played the short version. That was the first minute of, damn it, I hate when I do this. I hit the wrong one. Hold on, let me try to cue in to, I've got the full one here. All right, so let me pick up sort
of
where we left off.
Many of us would love to be taxed for the things we are solely and individually responsible for. But we are American citizens and thus bound to a collective enterprise that extends beyond our individual and personal reach. It would seem ridiculous to dispute invocations of the founders or the greatest generation on the basis of a lack of membership in either group. We recognize our lineage as a generational trust, as inheritance. And the real dilemma posed by reparations is just that, a dilemma of inheritance. It is impossible to imagine America without the inheritance of slavery. As historian Ed Baptist has written, enslavement, quote, shaped every crucial aspect of the economy and politics of America, so that by 1836, more than 600 million, or almost half of the economic activity in the United States, derived directly or indirectly from the cotton produced by the million-odd slaves. By the time the enslaved were emancipated, they comprised the largest single asset in America, $3 billion in 1860 dollars, more than all the other assets in the country combined. The method of cultivating this asset was neither gentle cajoling nor persuasion, but torture, rape, and child trafficking. Enslavement reigned for 250 years on these shores. When it ended, this country could have extended its hallowed principles, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness to all regardless of color. But America had other principles in mind. And so for a century after the Civil War, black people were subjected to a relentless campaign of terror, a campaign that extended well into the lifetime of Majority Leader McConnell. It is tempting to divorce this modern campaign of terror, of plunder, from enslavement. But the logic of enslavement, of white supremacy, respects no such borders. And the god of bondage was lustful and begat many heirs, coup d'etats and convict leasing, vagrancy laws and debt peonage, redlining and racist GI bills, poll taxes and state-sponsored terrorism. We grant that Mr. McConnell was not alive for Appomattox, but he was alive for the electrocution of George Stinney. He was alive for the blinding of Isaac Woodward. He was alive to witness kleptocracy in his native Alabama and a regime premised on electoral theft. Majority Leader McConnell cited civil rights legislation yesterday, as well he should, because he was alive to witness the harassment, jailing, and betrayal of those responsible for that legislation by a government sworn to protect them. He was alive for the redlining of Chicago and the looting of black homeowners of some $4 billion. Victims of that plunder are very much alive today. I am sure they'd love a word with the majority leader. What they know, what this committee must know, is that while emancipation deadbolted the door against the bandits of America, Jim Crow wedged the windows wide open. And that is the thing about Senator McConnell's something. It was 150 years ago, and it was right now. The typical black family in this country has 1/10 the wealth of the typical white family. Black women die in childbirth at 4 times the rate of white women. And there is, of course, the shame of this land of the free, boasting the largest prison population on the planet, of which the descendants of the enslaved make up the largest share. The matter of reparations is one of making amends and direct redress, but it is also a question of citizenship. In H.R. 40, this body has a chance to both make good on its 2009 apology for enslavement and reject fair-weather patriotism, to say that a nation is both its credits and its debits, that if Thomas Jefferson matters, so does Sally Hemings, that if D-Day matters, so does Black Wall Street, that if Valley Forge matters, so does Fort Pillow. Because the question really is not whether we will be tied to the somethings of our past, but whether we are courageous enough to be tied to the whole of them.
Mm.
Thank you.
Ta-Nehisi Coates, testifying this morning before a House Judiciary Committee subcommittee on civil rights and what is the actual subcommittee name? Of course, I had to start going there. The subcommittee that deals with this stuff. And he was brilliant, right? It's the Subcommittee on the Constitution, Civil Rights, and Civil Liberties. Again, a subcommittee of the House Judiciary Committee. So Ta-Nehisi Coates, that was his opening statement, and brilliant. And by the way, the article to which I very clumsily referred earlier was called The Case for Reparations, with Mr. Coates laying out the case in a brilliant article for The Atlantic. I will link to that in today's blog post as well. So all this stuff will be in one place for you to see. We've got the Parody Project video that I opened the show with. We'll have the Ta-Nehisi Coates opening statement, at least the audio, if not the video, his case for reparations. And because there are more than one viewpoint on this, I do want to play for you at least some of another witness who spoke, who disagrees. And you know what? I should be fair. I'd play the whole thing because these opening statements are about 5 minutes. So this man is named Coleman Hughes. He's an author and a columnist. And, he has a different view on reparations, another African-American. This is, again, Coleman Hughes, his opening statement at this morning's hearing.
Nothing I'm about to say is meant to minimize the horror and brutality of slavery and Jim Crow.
Okay.
Racism is a bloody stain on this country's history, and I consider our failure to pay reparations directly to freed slaves after the Civil War to be one of the greatest injustices ever perpetrated by the U.S. government. But I worry that our desire to fix the past compromises our ability to fix the present. Think about what we're doing today. We're spending our time debating a bill that mentions slavery 25 times, but incarceration only once, in an era with no black slaves, but nearly a million black prisoners. A bill that doesn't mention homicide once, at a time when the Center for Disease Control reports homicide as the number one cause of death for young black men. I'm not saying that acknowledging history doesn't matter. Hmm. It does.
Right.
I'm saying there's a difference between acknowledging history and allowing history to distract us from the problems we face today. In 2008, the House of Representatives formally apologized for slavery and Jim Crow. In 2009, the Senate did the same. Black people don't need another apology. We need safer neighborhoods and better schools. We need a less punitive criminal justice system.
Yes, we do.
We need affordable health care.
You know,
and none of these things can be achieved through reparations for slavery.
That's true. You hear some
nearly boos
in
everyone
the gallery.
Close to me, nearly everyone close to me told me not to testify today. They told me that even though I've only ever voted for Democrats, I'd be perceived as a Republican and therefore hated by half the country. Others told me that by distancing myself from Republicans, I would end up angering the other half of the country. And the sad truth is that they were both right. That's how suspicious we've become of one another. That's how divided we are as a nation. If we were to pay reparations today, we would only divide the country further, making it harder to build the political coalitions required to solve the problems facing black people today. We would insult many black Americans by putting a price on the suffering of their ancestors. And we would turn the relationship between black Americans and white Americans from a coalition into a transaction, from a union between citizens into a lawsuit between plaintiffs and defendants. What we should do is pay reparations to black Americans who actually grew up under Jim Crow and were directly harmed by second-class citizenship, people like my grandparents. But paying reparations to all descendants of slaves is a mistake. Take me, for example. I was born 3 decades after the end of Jim Crow into a privileged household in the suburbs. I attend an Ivy League school. Yet I'm also descended from slaves who worked on Thomas Jefferson's Monticello plantation. So reparations for slavery would allocate federal resources to me, but not to an American with the wrong ancestry, even if that person is living paycheck to paycheck and working multiple jobs to support a family. You might call that justice. I call it justice for the dead at the price of justice for the living. I understand that reparations are about what people are owed, regardless of how well they're doing. I understand that. But the people who are owed for slavery are no longer here, and we're not entitled to collect on their debts. Reparations, by definition, are only given to victims. So the moment you give me reparations, you've made me into a victim without my consent. Not just that. You've made one-third of Black Americans who poll against reparations into victims without their consent. And Black Americans have fought too long for the right to define themselves to be spoken for in such a condescending manner. The question is not what America owes me by virtue of my ancestry. The question is what all Americans owe each other by virtue of being citizens of the same nation. And the obligation of citizenship is not transactional. It's not contingent on ancestry. It never expires, and it can't be paid off. For all these reasons, Bill H.R. 40 is a moral and political mistake. Thank you.
So, again, that was a man named Coleman Hughes. You heard a few boos during his testimony there. That was his opening statement at the hearing that I believe is still going on slavery reparations in a House Judiciary Subcommittee. Hearing on this Juneteenth, a perfect day to discuss these things. And I'm thankful that Congress is holding this hearing. And it's interesting to hear those two conflicting viewpoints back to back, because I think they both made good points. Again, this is not my fight. It's not my issue. I hear what both of these gentlemen said, and I can agree with both of them on different points. Would you like to weigh in? The phone lines are open today. We do not have a guest on the show today. 954-889-6410 is the phone number. If you're on Skype, you can Skype me. I'm just at Nicole Sandler, all one word. Yeah, feel free to weigh in. But today there are other things going on that, when you think of them in the context of Juneteenth, are really disturbing. For instance, the president, or as I like to call him, the resident, the guy who's occupying the Oval Office, Dump, D'UMP. Donald Trump, you know, there's a new movie out on Netflix, which I still have not gotten around to watching, but it's on my list, dealing with the saga of the Central Park Five. You may recall that back in the 80s, Donald Trump, who thought he was the king of New York, just the way he thinks he's the king of America right now, took out a full-page ad in the New York Times saying that the Central Park Five should be executed. Now, by way of explanation, in case you don't remember the case or don't know what happened there, these five young African Americans were accused of raping a jogger in Central Park. And again, Donald Trump took out a full page ad saying they should be executed through coercion and everything else. I suppose I guess there were some confession under duress, but they were later cleared. These five young men were cleared when the convicted murderer and serial rapist came forward, confessed to the attack, said he had committed it alone, and the DNA evidence backed up his confession. These five young men were released from prison. New York City settled with them to the tune of millions of dollars. So, April Ryan at the White House yesterday asked Donald Trump if, you know, he would apologize. And this is the exchange. This was Trump's answer to April Ryan.
April. Mr. President, will you apologize to Central Park 5? They've been exonerated. There have been videos and movies shown about the case. And you came out with a full-page ad saying that they should die. They face the death penalty.
Why do you bring that question up now? It's an interesting time to bring it up. You have people on both sides of that. They admitted their guilt. If you look at Linda Fairstein and if you look at some of the prosecutors, they think that the city should never have settled that case.
Oh, my
so
God.
So we'll leave it at that.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. This bigot, this racist, this sick excuse for a human being is... still saying that these men were guilty and that the city shouldn't have settled with them. There are no words. There are just no words. Yes, Mastermind in the YouTube chat room says Trump is a racist prick. We all know this. Yes, he is. All right, we've got a couple of calls coming in. So I think we've got two people on the line, actually. We'll start off with the 305 area code. Hi, who's this?
Hi, that's the 305-379 number.
Oh, yeah, that's you. Yep.
Hi, this is Call Me Trip on your chat room. Trip
hey.
Is my name.
Hey, Trip. It's good to hear from
you.
Hey,
how you doing, Nicole?
Good. So what did you think of those two clips? Yeah.
Yes, both clips were interesting. And I just wanted to distinguish something, my disagreement with Coleman Hughes.
Okay.
My primary issue with his is the framing of the issue, right? So Coleman seems to be focused on a single solitary lump sum payout as reparations. I'm not so certain that he's looking at the actual gamut of what reparations would look like. Reparations wouldn't necessarily be a cash payout, in my opinion, at all. First of all, you have difficulty identifying the class, but you do not have difficulty identifying those who are affected by the vestiges of slavery that remain. Jim Crow being the last legalized form of it, but institutional racism that still exists in the way of mass incarceration.
Oh, yeah.
You can look at childbirth rates, as Ta-Nehisi pointed out. Any number of factors can be looked at and seen to still be vestiges of slavery. So reparations for me would be institutional constructs that are specifically funded to address those remnants or active measures that are in place right now. Things like the voters' rights amendment that Justice Roberts wanted to overthrow, perhaps to offset that, or he actually overthrew, perhaps to offset that, we have funding that allows people not to have to pay these poll taxes for their reinstatement of their civil rights in Florida.
Right.
There are a number of issues, a ton of issues that Coleman didn't address. Personally, one that I've heard no one mention, because it is fraught with its own challenges, would be, as a reparation, DNA analysis for all African Americans to discern who our family is, as we were legally separated 2-3 generations ago.
That's right.
We don't know who our family is, quite literally.
Mm-hmm.
HBCUs, the funding of those institutions that were created, institutions like the National, first of all, here's one, National Bar Association, National Medical Association. Whenever you see national in one of those associations are created because African Americans couldn't have their own. I sit on the board of directors for a subsection for the National Bar Association commercial law section. We do a lot. There's a lot more we could do to help that pipeline of getting African Americans to be representing 13%, which is our number, of those attorneys in America.
Mm-hmm.
So reparations can come in a lot of different ways, and so I would distinguish Coleman's argument, because he seems to be focused on a very narrow portion of what reparations would look like.
Right.
For me, reparations is institutional change.
I hear you, and I think is the no-brainer here. I do think when the general public at large, who is not as well-versed on the topic as you are, hear about reparations, they're thinking cash. That's why we need to have these discussions. And like I said, I've been looking. I just got one of the listeners in one of the chat rooms sent me a couple of names who are in the thick of the discussion about reparations. I know that there's one group, the ADOS, what is it?
Yes.
ADOS stand for?
American Descendants of Slaves.
Thank you. And there's a controversy around them, right?
I'm not a fan.
Right.
I have a couple of friends who are actually in that movement, right? Through Tim Black's show, there are a couple of girls who I met, and they're friends. But I believe that, honestly, I really believe the ABLIS movement is another one of those counter subterfuge movements by Russia, frankly. It goes counter to everything you would think. They're not only are they pro-reparations, they're isolating the black diaspora from itself. They ignore that the victims of slavery aren't necessarily descendants of slaves. That's why I say it's an institutional approach.
Right.
The victims of slavery, if you're an African American and you move into this country in 1950, you suffered from the same vestiges of slavery that I did. Maybe not for as long as I did, but your children don't get judged whether or not they were descendants of slaves. They get judged whether or not they have the wrong melanin. It is
right.
a phenotypical issue, not a heritage issue.
Right.
So
for me,
reparations would address the phenotypical issues that arise from slavery. It's just one man's opinion.
No, and I agree with you. And Tripp, you're making amazing points. But that it also talks to what Coleman Hughes was saying, that, you know, just because somebody, he said he is the descendant of slaves who worked at Thomas Jefferson's Monticello. But he doesn't need financial assistance. He's one of the lucky ones, right? And he said, what about the people who are not descendants of slaves, black people who are suffering under this institutionalized racism we have in this country, which comes as a natural outgrowth of slavery? What's to say
they... I wouldn't disagree.
Right, me either.
I wouldn't disagree with him about identifying the specifics of it, but he went on to then... Now, he not only distinguishes it, though, he eliminates it and uses it as a weapon.
Okay.
So if there was a monetary value that was able to be assessed... Here's a perfect example. We recently found the will of my great-great-grandfather. My father was born in 22, but he was born to a man that was born in 95, who was born to a slave, right? We found the will where my great-great-grandfather bequeathed my great-great-grandmother and my great-grandfather to his son. We identified that. My last name is Phillips. I'll put that on the air.
Okay.
We identified that, and we were able to literally link up with that side of the family.
Wow.
And they immediately shut us down because that whole side of the family that also still bears the name Phillips inherited everything. The grandchild from that plantation is still, she's a 98-year-old woman, she's still alive.
Wow.
They want nothing to do with us because they think we literally have a legal entitlement. We have no interest in enforcing it. That being said, whether or not we pursued that kind of a claim, the claim that I could pursue would be the fact that redlining existed in my lifetime. When I went to get hired by the bank, my first bank I worked for coming out of college, they literally told me we're waiting for a location to open that fits your demographic.
Oh, God.
In other words, you, top of your class coming out of our very prestigious management school, need to go to a certain type of community. You could imagine what that looked like.
Uh-huh.
And it's less opportunity that committee. All I did was crush it, but that's neither here nor there. The point being, just because you make it out of that cycle doesn't mean you didn't suffer from that cycle.
Sure.
And I can tell Mr. Coleman that if he thinks that his wealth or his success financially assists him to escape the reparations we're talking about, wait till he gets pulled over.
Exactly. Because he's still guilty of driving while black.
That needs to be addressed.
Of course. And
correct.
And depending where he's driving through, there are many places still today in 2019 that you get, we've seen it. I mean, we've seen what happens to black people driving.
So I don't disagree with him in principle, but I do think his vision is a little myopic.
Yep.
And I also agree with you. The framing of the issue as purely financial is disservice by someone like that because he literally didn't even discuss the other ramifications.
Right.
What Coates did was discuss the totality of it and discuss the historical aspect that still has its remnants present in our existence now. Coleman seemed to take a snapshot that on Juneteenth we'll measure everything from before. That's the flaw of ADOS. They do the same. They don't look at what's going on now. They literally feel antagonistic towards people who are foreign born. I truly think it's a counterintelligence or a counter movement, a subversive movement of foreign entities, similar to what happened in 2016 when a bunch of black folks decided that they couldn't vote for the Democratic nominee because of her past. It later came out that that was Russia. I don't know who it is now, but Ados obviously isn't something that talks to the black diaspora.
Mm-hmm.
But there are good people, you know, there are good, passionate people behind it, but that's not the focus of
right.
the lobby.
In fact, and I'm not by far not an expert on what happened or the situation, but I know that there was a run-in between somebody from Ados and Mark Thompson, who used to host the morning show on XM's, you know, 127 Progress channel, who was fired because of this incident where this Ados guy, who had been harassing him, kept, you know, nudging him and finally, like, touched him. There was video of the incident, and Mark hauled off and hit him. And because of that altercation, he was fired. I thought it was justifiable based on the way this guy was harassing him. Regardless, Mark Thompson is no longer at Sirius XM, and it was because of a disagreement with these Ados people. So it's an important discussion. I just want to make sure that I'm talking to the right people. I didn't want to invite Ados on and know that, you know, a lot of people like you and for instance, Mark Thompson say, no, they're not the ones to talk to about this.
Well, I mean, you can, in my opinion. I think it'd be you had an interview, and I'm drawing a blank now, Trump supporting con artist who I think he got convicted recently. He had an interview with him.
Roger Stone.
Roger Stone.
Yes.
It would be along those lines.
If
you listen to the Ados for 10 minutes, you'll know they're full of
bleep,
but well-intentioned for what their beliefs are.
Here's my problem with it, Tripp, and you've been listening long enough. You know me well enough to know I don't feel confident enough in my grasp of the issue because I'm not living it to be the right person to question them with the authority and the toughness that I like to bring to my interviews. And so I'm ultra sensitive because I don't want to fuck it up. I don't want to inadvertently offend somebody by coming at it the wrong way. I realize this is not my, you know, hill to die on. This is not my issue that I'm an expert on, but it's really important that we talk about it.
I would say that Ados is a friend, in my opinion, just my opinion. Mm-hmm. They're fringe,
mm-hmm.
But if you don't agree with fringe, you could agree they're not reflective of the diasporic approach.
Gotcha.
Because they would tell you that.
Okay.
But what I would like to say is thank you so very much on this Juneteenth for having this candid discussion, and any guests you get will be welcome. We love the hell out of you. Your audience loves you. I love you.
Well,
I listen to every chance
I get. You're awesome.
And I just appreciate you.
Well, thank you. And I'm glad I'm able to do this. That's why I said, you know what? If I couldn't get a guest to talk about this, that's fine. We got a lot of stuff we can talk about. I can take your calls, and there's lots of information to get out there. Again, I'm mortified in learning more about Juneteenth that this day is not a holiday and that there are big parts of the country, for instance, me growing up in New York, that I never even heard the word Juneteenth. Never heard it before.
Right.
So
yeah, Juneteenth was something we grew up with. But, you know, the holiday thing, I wonder, a friend of mine this morning, and he's actually a bit of a right-winger,
uh-huh.
Suggested we should have it as a national holiday. And my opinion was, no, we should have it. I would like to see it as a day we recognize that everyone knows it is.
Yes.
But I don't want it to become commodified.
Yeah, you don't want it to be mattress sales, right?
It's a celebration, but it's a celebration of not just pain, but if you really think about it, it's a celebration of the fact that the federal government couldn't even enforce its own laws for that period of time. And if you don't think there were slaves on other plantations that didn't find out for long after, it was a long time.
That's what I was reading in that article. Yeah. They kept them until after the harvest. They didn't want them knowing that they were free. That's horrible. Just our history is so, so horrible. Let me ask you this. As long as I've got you on the phone, Tripp, I know that you happen to be a Joe Biden supporter. I don't think he's your number one choice, but he's in your top.
He's my number two.
He's your number two. Oh,
yes.
See, and this I don't understand. I mean, we're all entitled to our
three. Because Warren is really pushing.
Warren's good, right?
Okay. I've loved Liz for so long. You know that.
I do have some questions that I've been researching because I've got a few issues. But again, let me reiterate: none of the candidates are going to agree with me or you 100%. Just not going to happen. And so we need to, you know, weigh the good against the bad. And I'm a big Elizabeth Warren fan, but I'm not a big Joe Biden fan. And as we're talking about racism, I got to bring this this up and get your thoughts on this and see if you don't have a problem with it. First of all, when he left the Poor People's Forum this weekend where he spoke, he immediately went to a big, high-priced fundraiser where there were a number of Republicans present, just, you know, a big, big fundraiser. Then yesterday, Biden was at a fundraiser at the Carlyle Hotel in New York, and he made some statements. He said, quote, "I was in a caucus with James O. Eastland, who is a known segregationist and a racist." I added those words in. Back to Joe Biden. "He never called me boy. He always called me son." At that same fundraiser, Biden also praised his relationship with former Georgia Senator Herman Talmadge, another late, staunch segregationist who opposed civil rights. Biden called him, quote, "one of the meanest guys I ever knew," but he added, "at least there was some civility. We didn't agree on much of anything. We got things done." These are horrible racist people that instead of calling them out, he basically said, you know, there's good and bad on both sides. Both sides do. He reminded me of Donald Trump. This is not an issue.
I didn't hear it. I didn't hear it that way.
Okay.
So let me tell you how I heard it.
Okay.
And how I think it'll be. And I hear the uproar that people are making about it. Even Booker chimed in on it, which I thought was because I can tell you what I've talked to other folks about. I had lunch with a friend today who we've never talked politics, and we talked about that. We both heard it the same way. What Biden was saying was our truth, what we actually live. Because every day we work and deal with racists. Like, that's not a big deal.
Right.
Like, long as he may have never called me that, but yeah, he was a racist, but he never called me that. It goes back to the old adage. In the North, they had racists, but in the South, we had laws. And that's all he's saying. He's saying that this was a known bigot, but at least they had civility to come together on certain issues. But yeah, he's a bigot. You know, a quick anecdote that may enlighten it. When I was in high school, there was a neo-Nazi threatening a guy in my kitchen that worked in a restaurant. And me and this guy got into a fight, and we fought these two neo-Nazis. That guy was a known Klansman.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes it happens.
The enemy of my enemy is my friend.
Be my friend.
Right. I got you. Right.
But so with Biden, the reason I'm not offended by that statement, I think it was dumb, but I understood it. It was the truth of the time. In the 70s, in the 60s, in the 50s, anyone we loved, LBJ. My big beef with LBJ isn't that he was friendly with the South, but that literally people ignore that he did a lot of Bidenist things. They give it credit as a man of his time. Biden has evolved from that, but he's just pointing back to a time that even when the black congressional caucus worked with some of those Dixiecrats, because it was the only way to get things done. And that's all he's saying. He's saying that now you can't even do that. Like, you can't even work with the other side without getting tarred and feathered as being the enemy. I think that's what he was pointing at.
Right, but
now,
don't you think he should have learned from Barack Obama's two terms that the Republicans are not going to work with you no matter how much you bend over to appease them?
Correct. I think he has, but I think his point. I think that's the point he was highlighting.
Okay.
I think his point was, it's so bad now that even back then, even racists worked with us.
Uh-huh.
It's so bad now that even racists worked with us.
Wow.
But now we can't even get anybody to work with us.
Tripp,
we need to bring people together.
I give you so much credit. We disagree on a number of things, Joe Biden being chief among them.
We don't have to agree to love each other.
I love you too. By the way, the YouTube chat room is very jealous that you hang out in the NicoleSandler.com chat room. They want your presence. They're enjoying your commentary and your voice.
Only when I can't get into my chat room, my buddies like Proud and August and Jalel and everybody else.
We got a great group in there too. I've got two wonderful chat rooms.
Tripp,
thank you for calling in. Thank you for your wonderful input. I really appreciate it. I'll talk
Thanks
to you later.
Bye.
Take care. Bye-bye. That's listener Tripp. Yes, he is a regular in the NicoleSandler.com chat room, and he's been a listener for years and has been very, very supportive. Again, this is what I love about Tripp and my listeners. Tripp is a hell of a lot more conservative than I am, and we disagree on things. Like, I think that Joe Biden would be the worst possible candidate for the Democrats to nominate. There you heard Tripp saying he was number two. Well, now number three, because Elizabeth Warren has knocked him out of second place. Let's hope it's not Biden. I don't want Biden. Okay. Anyway, we've come to the end of another show. And we didn't even get to what's news. So I'll tell you what, stick around. We'll hit what's news at the end of the program. for those of you listening to the live show. If you're listening on Progressive Voices, well, you'll get what's news throughout the day because they play it. Thank you for indulging me in today's conversation. I think it's a really important conversation that we need to have more of. And I'll try to leave a day open every now and again to take calls. I like being able to talk to you guys. I don't do it more often because, frankly, half the time when I do, you don't call in. But I knew today this is a topic that we should all be talking about. I believe his number one is Kamala Harris. Anyway, with that, we're done. Tomorrow, Wendell Potter will be here. You may recall the name. I'll refresh your memory tomorrow. But we're going to talk about people's misconceptions about Medicare for All. All right. See you tomorrow, everyone. Thanks for listening. Bye.
I read the news today, oh boy.
It's time for Nicole Sandler's What's News from NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
Patrick Shanahan, the acting Secretary of Defense, withdrew his name from consideration for the permanent post Tuesday, just as the Washington Post published a story detailing a violent incident in 2011 in which his son attacked his own mother with a baseball bat.
President Trump announcing his pick to lead the Pentagon will withdraw before he's even been formally nominated. Writing on Twitter that Acting Defense Secretary Patrick Shanahan, who has done a wonderful job, has decided not to go forward with his confirmation process so that he can devote more time to his family. Trump said he'll name Army Secretary Mark Esper as the new Acting Defense Secretary, but declined to say whether that would become permanent. Shanahan is the former Boeing executive who had been running the Defense Department since James Mattis resigned in protest in December, but only in an acting capacity until Trump announced last month he would make things official. But the paperwork was never filed, raising eyebrows inside the White House about why. Now CNN has learned his resignation came amid details of a contentious divorce, including an allegation from Shanahan's ex-wife that he hit her during a dispute 9 years ago, an allegation Shanahan has denied. His ex-wife was arrested and charged with assault, but those charges were later dropped. In a statement today, Shanahan said he was resigning to protect his children, writing, "I would welcome the opportunity to be Secretary of Defense, but not at the expense of being a good father."
The Senate Appropriations Committee struck a deal Tuesday evening to move ahead with the president's $4.5 billion request for funding to deal with the ongoing crisis at the southern border. The agreement will be marked up in the Senate Appropriations Committee on Wednesday and is expected to reach the Senate floor before lawmakers leave next week for the 4th of July recess. The package is expected to include billions in humanitarian aid to shore up the Department of Health and Human Services Office of Refugee Resettlement. Senators and administration officials had warned that without more money, the office would run out of funding by early next month. Wednesday is Juneteenth. That's the day that commemorates the June 19, 1865 announcement of the emancipation of enslaved African Americans throughout the former Confederate states. The House Judiciary Committee is holding a hearing on reparations, where journalist Ta-Nehisi Coates and actor and activist Danny Glover are set to testify in favor of compensation for the descendants of slaves. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell on Tuesday dismissed the idea of reparations for slavery, arguing that civil rights legislation and former President Barack Obama's election show they are unnecessary.
I don't think reparations for something that happened 150 years ago, for whom none of us currently living are responsible, is a good idea. We've, you know, tried to deal with our original sin of slavery by fighting a civil war, by passing landmark civil rights legislation. We've elected an African-American president. I think we're always a work in progress in this country, but no one currently alive was responsible for that. And I don't think we should be trying to figure out how to compensate for it. First of all, it'd be pretty hard to figure out who to compensate. We've had waves of immigrants as well who've come to the country and experienced dramatic discrimination of one kind or another. So, no, I don't think reparations are a good idea.
Former Trump aide Hope Hicks is the first witness close to Donald Trump to testify before the House Judiciary Committee in its investigation into alleged abuses of power. Hicks is set to answer questions behind closed doors Wednesday, and a committee transcript will be released soon after.
The administration is asserting immunity for Hicks from testifying about her time in the White House.
President Trump blocking Hope Hicks from handing over documents to Congress, documents required under subpoena. Hope Hicks' attorney tonight saying in a new letter to Congress the documents could fall under executive privilege. Now, keep in mind, Hicks is crucial. She's as inner circle for Trump as it gets. She was a witness to some of the most controversial moments in Mueller's report. And that is why Democrats investigating obstruction want her to hand over documents from her time at the White House. But Hicks is not the only star witness Trump is trying to keep quiet. The White House also blocking former White House counsel Don McGahn's chief of staff from cooperating, Annie Donaldson. Her notes were quoted extensively in the Mueller report, central to it. And at this hour, the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, Jerry Nadler, in a statement, says this is all evidence of the president's continued obstruction of congressional investigations.
Committee Chairman Jerry Nadler has rejected the preemptive claims of executive privilege over what Hicks has to say. The White House continues to stonewall the committee from receiving documents or testimony from key figures, including Attorney General William Barr, former White House counsel Don McGahn, and former special counsel Robert Mueller, who remains unwilling to testify publicly. The number of refugees and displaced people on the planet has hit an all-time high. According to a new UN report, more than 70 million people have been forced to flee home because of violence or persecution. That works out to about one in every 108 people on Earth. And that's just a bit of what's news for now. I'm Nicole Sandler. If you appreciate these reports and the Nicole Sandler Show, I hope you'll consider making a contribution. My work is 100% listener supported, and I can't do it without your help. For more information, visit NicoleSandler.com/donate.